This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Barron's Live, the outlook for this year's proxy season. I'm Leslie Norton, senior writer at Barron's. Joining us today are Jim Copeland, senior fellow and director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute, and Jonas Kron, chief advocacy officer at Trillium Asset Management. Among his many roles at Manhattan Institute, Jim keeps tabs on proxy season through his publicly available proxymonitor.org database. And Jonas leads shareholder advocacy at Trillium, which is a prominent sustainable investing firm. Welcome, Jim and Jonas. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So before we start, I'd like to remind the audience to submit questions for Jim and Jonas to answer at the end of the podcast. So proxy season is a springtime ritual in corporate America. It's when most companies have their annual shareholder meetings and shareholders get to vote on things like electing new directors or approving management's compensation plan. It's also when shareholders make their own proposals about initiatives they think company management should adopt. This year in particular, we're seeing an array of proposals drafted in response to the events of 2020. We had a deadly pandemic and widespread protests following the death of George Floyd in police custody. This morning, for example, we saw an open letter published in the Financial Times from Majority Action and the Service Employees International Union and other signatories. Among other things, the letter urges big asset managers like Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street to oppose all white boards or those with quote unquote arguably token representation by a single person of color. Jonas, I'd like to start with you because Trillium, your firm, signed this letter. Why did the signatories feel a need to write this letter during this time? And why target these particular firms?
Thanks, Leslie. Well, in 2020, as you were saying, you know, there were all the events surrounding the murder of George Floyd and the focus on racial justice. And in the wake of all of that, these asset managers and many more, many companies, made some pretty strong and important statements about racial justice and their commitments to help address systemic racism. And those were important things to say. It's important for large institutions like these to put a name to what is happening and to acknowledge it and to say it's important. But then those words really need to be translated into action. And for investors, one of the most fundamental ways that we take action is through our proxy votes. It's not the only thing we can do, and I think that's important, but it is a foundational step to take. And I think probably as most listeners know, the big index funds like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, they control a significant share of the vote at virtually all publicly traded companies. And so, like, for example, at Johnson & Johnson, which has its annual meeting day after tomorrow on Thursday, those three shareholders control over 20% of the vote that'll be exercised on Thursday. You add in the next three largest shareholders, and you're immediately over 25% of the vote at that point. So the 2021 proxy season really offers these firms an important opportunity to act on those commitments, to align their proxy votes. And I guess what I would describe as an authentic and an impactful way with their commitments to racial justice. And I think if they don't, I think what this letter points out is that if they don't, then all of the accusations that have been sort of thrown around over the last 9 months, that words are empty, that words are meaningless, I think those would be proven true if they don't follow through.
Right. So obviously, race is a big deal this proxy season. Jim, you're a student of proxies. What trends are you seeing this year, particularly with race and any other initiatives?
Yeah, we definitely are seeing an uptick in proxy shareholder proposals, and it's important to realize shareholder proposals are just a piece of what boards are getting from institutional investors, but they are a tool for communicating from institutional investors with the boards. And we're seeing a significant increase we've always had a lot of environmental proposals, but a significant increase, I would say, in environmental related proposals, and particularly in race-oriented shareholder proposals. There's a new shareholder proposal about a racial equity audit, which is showing up on a lot of the big company proxy statements this proxy season. And you know, we've seen a little of this before, and we've always seen sort of employee rights and human rights related shareholder proposals. But there's a significant difference this proxy season, fueled by precisely the sorts of events and public reaction that Jonas was talking about. So I expect that we'll have votes on them. It's hard to predict, what the votes will actually look like, notwithstanding various social activists, including, social investing firms like Trillium and other activists and union folks, pressing on this publicly. That's not that new. It's just a new subject matter. And so the question there will be, for the institutional investors who traditionally have voted against or abstained on most of these sorts of questions when they're put on the proxy ballot. And the reason for that isn't that the institutional investors are adverse to the interest of racial justice, racial equity, et cetera. It's that this is probably not the venue for it. And that's important to realize, they have fiduciary duties to maximize share value for their investors, clients who are individual investors with a broad array of opinion on these sort of social issues, and trust their money with them. And so by and large, while they do engage in dialogue and certainly things like board diversity, there's been an increase and an uptick in some of the dialogue in recent years with institutional investors and management, by and large, they don't tend to support these precatory shareholder proposals, and they've tended to get relatively low support and very rarely have any of the sort of social issue oriented shareholder proposals got majority shareholder voting support. We have seen some climate related shareholder proposals get narrow majority shareholder voting support in recent years, which is a shift from past practice. And so we're going to keep watching it. I do think that some of the folks running these funds will be worried about being fingered out on this. And so we may see some differences from what we've seen historically, realizing, of course, again, that these are advisory shareholder proposals and the boards don't necessarily have to implement them exactly as worded in the proposal itself.
Right. So when you say they're advisory, companies don't have to adopt them at all, correct?
It's not at all binding on the board. The reason why companies do react to this is twofold. One, I mean, if a significant chunk of your institutional investors are saying we care about something, companies are going to take notice because, I don't think it's likely that most of these institutional investors would actually sell their shares on that. And I don't think it's likely that if they did, it would materially or in the long run affect the stock price, because somebody else who didn't care about the issue would buy it up at a discount, which is why we see this sort of shareholder proxy voting proposal activism in the first place. It's that institutional investors, once upon a time, a social investing fund might have said, well, we're just not going to invest in certain sectors. We don't like military. We don't like tobacco or what have you. We don't like oil. We're not going to invest in that sector. But ultimately, that's not really going to drive management performance much, because somebody else out there is saying, we don't care about this. They're going to buy up the discounted price and bid it right back up to the price, which is incorporating the market's best efficient knowledge of the discounted value of future free cash flows flowing to the shareholders. So because of that, they've gone much more to this sort of using the shareholder proposal vehicle as a platform for issue advocacy in these various areas. And because these companies and institutional investors are concerned with consumer demand, and in some cases may genuinely really care about the issue as well, but because they're concerned with consumer demand, even if they're acting in an economic sense, they're going to be reactive to these sorts of proposals. But they don't have to react. They will react, though, because they're worried about what institutional investors think, but even more so, and because I'm making the claim that other investors are going to trade the price back up if Trillium sells its shares, I think that's true. I don't think Trillium can drive prices in the total stock market. But because institutional shareholder services, Glass Lewis, the proxy advisory firms, will often make director voting decisions predicated upon how boards of directors react even to precatory shareholder proposals, they're going to be responsive to that because there's a large number of institutional investors who follow those voting recommendations, some directly robo-voting recommendations of proxy advisory firms and giving them disproportionate weight in the market. Right. And because of that, you're going to see boards react even though they're advisory and it's not materially going to affect their share price.
Got it. Okay. Thank you very much. There's a lot to unpack there, Jonas. I feel certain that you have things to say, but why don't you tell us first about your new shareholder proposal at Alphabet, the parent of Google this year. Describe the proposal. Tell us why you decided to bring it.
Sure. And just one quick sort of observation just on what Jim was saying. I think one of the things on the racial justice audit proposals that'll be sort of interesting is that BlackRock has already agreed to conduct a racial justice audit itself, and Morgan Stanley have too. These were both in responses to the shareholder proposals that were filed. So how they vote, so like, for example, Trillium has one of these proposals that we filed on racial justice audit at Johnson & Johnson. How BlackRock, how Morgan Stanley are going to vote on that, and in light of the fact that they are going to be doing it and agreed to do it as well, I think will be an interesting piece of this to watch, because we are seeing more of these kind of proposals get majority votes. So for example, a shareholder proposal on workforce diversity at Travelers that we filed in 2019 got a majority vote, and that was before all of this. So, you're absolutely right. There's a lot to unpack there, and I appreciate the question about Alphabet. The proposal that we filed at Alphabet is actually a refiling. It was one that we'd filed last year that basically just asked the company to do a third-party review of its whistleblower policies. And there's probably a few pieces to get into here, but I will do that quickly. I think most listeners will know, that it's important to have good, strong whistleblower systems. They protect employees, they protect the public, and they protect investors, and that's really an important piece, I think, for investors to remember. That's why the Securities and Exchange Commission has a robust whistleblower office, because it's important for investor protection. We also know that companies that have strong whistleblower policies are correlated with companies that have strong corporate governance. So it's a good proxy for good management in general. Now, one of the challenges, though, is it's really hard for outsiders to assess the strength of whistleblower systems. So we end up having to look for red flags. And that sort of gets us to Alphabet, where red flags have been going off left and right, and really going back for a few years. But even if you just look at the last 6 months, it's really quite remarkable. In December, we saw the National Labor Relations Review file a complaint against Alphabet, alleging that Google was coercing employees when they were exercising their rights, illegally spying on employees, using intimidation to quell workplace activism. And actually, on the same day as that was filed, Google fired Dr. Gebru, who was the co-lead of the AI ethics team and was the founder of Black in AI, and was really one of the few Black women in leadership at the company. That was followed a month later by the formation of the Alphabet Union, which, among other things, is focused on protecting employees from retribution and retaliation. A month later, Google then fires the founder of the other co-founder of the AI ethics team, Dr. Margaret Mitchell, who was very active internally on human rights and diversity issues. Then in March, we see some more reporting coming out about employees experiencing unreasonable pressure when they seek to raise issues around racism or sexism. And then just a couple weeks ago, we saw the resignation of Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Gebru's boss in the AI ethics group. So there's a lot of indications that the whistleblower policies and practices and systems aren't working well. And really, Alphabet has not really provided any evidence that what they're doing is sufficient, that their whistleblower policies are effective. And that's really the point of a third-party audit, is to bring it in, identify your blind spots. You know, management has structural incentives to not do everything possible to strengthen those whistleblower protections, because every whistleblower represents a potential embarrassment for management. So this is a proposal that got went to a vote last year. I think with all votes at Alphabet, it's important to remember that they've got the dual class share structure. So Brin, Page, and Schmidt basically control a majority of the vote, and so that's always going to put their thumb on the scale of the vote.
Why is it important, Jonas, to bring shareholder proposals, even if you know that it can't possibly win with this kind of dual share class structure?
Well, it's sort of interesting. So Alphabet, just to sort of stay on that example, so we've been engaged in working with the company on environmental, social, and governance issues going back about 12 years at this point. In 2010, we filed a shareholder proposal when the company was not even doing any sustainability reporting at all. That shareholder proposal got about a 10% vote that year, so obviously a very low vote. But within about 18 months, the company started doing sustainability reporting. In 2019, we filed a shareholder proposal focused on the lack of leadership diversity at the very highest level of the named executive officers at Alphabet. That proposal got about 5% of the vote. But within a year, the company had implemented what's called a Rooney Rule for its executive team and board. That is, making sure that you had diverse candidates in the pool of candidates that you'd be selecting from to fill a position. So I think the reason we do continue to engage, even under these circumstances, is that we can see change, that the interests of outside shareholders are taken into account.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much for that. So I'm here with Jonas Kron of Trillion Asset Management and Jim Copeland of the Manhattan Institute. We're taking audience questions later on in the conversation, so please make sure to submit your questions on the topic of proxy season, which is underway here. Okay, so another kind of proposal we're seeing this year is called Say on Climate. Jonas, do tell us what a typical Say on Climate proposal entails and why it's so popular this year.
So let's see. So Say on Climate shareholder proposals are basically asking companies to do three things. One, disclose on an annual basis greenhouse gas emissions. Two, present a plan. Three, to hold a vote on that plan at their annual meeting. And we've already seen a couple of companies agree to hold these votes. Unilever, Moody's, Shell, Rio Tinto, Glencore. And we've seen, as you've mentioned, shareholder proposals being filed at a number of companies as well. You know, the supporters and proponents of these proposals really see it as a way to hold companies to account, to hold their feet to the fire, if you will. But what's interesting is that there is really a significant split in the investor community about these proposals. Recently, the New York City Comptroller and CalPERS really warned that these kind of votes could have some unintended consequences and actually take the pressure off of directors and basically get you into sort of a rubber stamp situation, not unlike the Say on Pay shareholder or Say on Pay votes that happen every year. New York State Common Retirement Fund also said that they're going to be abstaining. So there's certainly plenty of these proposals around, and there's been some interesting commitments already, but I think the jury is still out about what investors, within the ESG SRI community, think about these proposals.
Well, in fact, Jim, you also have concerns, just in generally speaking, about environmental and social shareholder proposals landing in the proxy. So tell us why that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an important point, and it's I want to emphasize, it doesn't mean that I necessarily disagree with the objective of the sponsors of the proposal in terms of the policy idea. I certainly, when it comes to, say, the whistleblowing proposal introduced at Alphabet the last couple of years that Jonas was talking about from Trillium, I certainly don't have a strong or informed opinion on the personnel policies about this person or that person being let go from a massive company like Google, nor am I going to defend Google in any or all these instances. But I do think it's important to think about why we have shareholder voting to begin with, and why I and to make the point why I think it should be a relatively circumscribed voting right. And we have voting rights essentially to protect the owners of equity shares, their interest in the company, because of there's a well-known sort of agency cost problem or a disjunction between the interests of the investors in the equity share and managers, because equity owners aren't able contractually to protect their interests in the way that employees are, customers are, suppliers are, and lenders are. In each of those sorts of cases, you have a contractual relationship, and there's a bargaining that goes on in some way, shape, or form, or at least you're accepting a clear bargain of what you're getting and what you're not, accepting bankruptcy situations. The contract is going to protect your interests. Whereas if you're an equity share owner, all you get is the residual interest in the corporation. And this is in fact a big cost to shareholders. You can't protect management from running off and spending all the money. And, how are your interests protected? Well, for publicly traded companies, you're able to sell your shares and buy new shares in a different company. And that, in fact, is the fundamental way that we protect individuals' interests. And that's why the SEC exists largely as a disclosure regime, so that you're making informed buy and sell decisions in those sorts of cases. But then beyond that, you have sort of a veneer of state corporate law fiduciary duties, and you have voting rights, particularly the rights to vote for or against directors and other significant changes to the corporate form. That works pretty well, but it needs to be a circumscribed right there to protect your interest, and not turn corporate proxy ballot voting into sort of mini proxy campaigns that embed this or that public policy issue of concern in the United States at a given moment. As soon as we do that, we're imposing lots and lots and lots of a different sort of agency costs on the corporation, and really undermining the whole reason why we have this form of corporate governance to begin with for our large complex business entities. It's important to realize that there's no law that prevents us from owning large business entities through employees, through customers, through suppliers. And in fact, we see those sorts of entities all over the place, but the biggest entities tend to be this, notwithstanding the agency costs. And a big reason for that, and there's an empirical evidence on the literature on this. My old Yale law professor taught me this 25 years ago. Henry Hansman wrote a book on it, The Ownership of Enterprise. And the reason why we have corporate equity capitalism to begin with is in large part to mitigate these sort of competing interests and prevent business entities from becoming these sorts of mini democracies. Democracy is the best form of government we know compared to all the others, but it's messy, and we all know that. And so instead of having these sort of mini proxy votes on all these issues, we delegate those to boards of directors, and we basically should, I think, have a much more circumscribed shareholder voting right. This isn't a surprise that I'm arguing this. I've argued it in the Wall Street Journal. I've argued it in comment letters to the Securities and Exchange Commission. But I think the more we start saying, well, we're going to vote on this or that climate package, then you're all of a sudden just creating an opportunity through your regulatory structure, because this is something that is pushed on the companies through SEC regulation to sort of politicize the business itself. Now, I realize this is a lot of what Trillium does, and there's nothing illegal with that, and there's certainly nothing wrong with individuals being able to invest as they see fit and to invest with a social purpose. I'm not arguing. But I think to have this sort of voting mechanism working this way comes with a lot of risks. And when you're saying something's popular, it's important to distinguish, I think, also between what's popular in terms of it's being pushed by a lot of shareholder proponents, and B, it's going to get a lot of votes from actual institutional investors who are voting on these shares. I mean, the very fact that the New York funds, who've been very active and very socially conscious, are saying they're going to abstain on a climate change voting right, tells you that it's probably not going to get a lot of shareholder votes. And the whistleblower proposal that last year at Alphabet was also introduced by Trillium, got 4.9% of the vote.
Right.
It was able to be reintroduced, notwithstanding 95.1% of the vote went the other way this year, because the old SEC threshold on shareholder proposals was a 3% minimum for the first year. That's been up to 5%, and in the future, so it would have to hit 5% to go forward. But you had 95% of shareholders voting the other way.
Jim, may I interrupt? Okay.
Certainly. Sorry.
Jonas, Jim said a lot of stuff there, and I think some of it you'd already addressed earlier, but tell us again why it's important for you to continue to bring these kinds of proposals.
Thanks. So I think what it really comes down to is information flow and a marketplace of ideas, and I think you really can't sort of understate that enough, that what shareholder proposals do is provide an opportunity for more information and an airing of risks and opportunities for the companies to have. And that was one of the interesting things. We've sort of been talking around this a little bit about what's been happening to the SEC with the rule amendments there on shareholder proposals. But what we really saw was from a lot of investors, particularly active investors, but passive investors as well, basically pointing out that shareholder proposals surface information that can strengthen each of our understandings of the risks and opportunities inherent in the companies that are going to be in our portfolios. And so any sort of action that comes in to limit some of those shareholder proposals, to limit the rights of individuals and organizations and asset managers to file those proposals, is really something that limits every shareholder's ability to really fully understand the companies that they are investing in and the risks and opportunities of their investments. So we really do believe in a very robust marketplace of ideas and of information, and that's how markets function well. Markets function on information, and we want to continue to have a full free flow of that information through shareholder proposal processes, through SEC disclosures, through all the different ways in which we collect and analyze information on shareholder proposals. So I think it's really important to see them in that way.
So we have just a few more minutes. It's 12:27. So we have one interesting question from a listener, which relates to one of the questions I still haven't asked, which is about the proposals, proliferation of proposals regarding political spending. And in fact, this was addressed in the majority action letter we just discussed earlier in our conversation. And the question from Hal is, what are your views on political advocacy by corporations, for example, on voter suppression laws? Jonas, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think probably the thing to remember here is that democracy is good for the economy. And that whether that is the ability to make sure that the public policy process is functioning efficiently to actually get good public policy in place that is supported by the American people and through a democratic process, that's all necessary for business to function well. Business functions in markets that are defined by public policy. And so, we've seen actually a fair amount of scholarship that show that healthy democracies lead to healthy economies and lead to healthy business environments. And so it's really in the interests of these companies to have a robust, healthy democracy in each and every state and nationally, because that's going to help them be more successful businesses.
Got it. Okay. So I think, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you to Jim Copeland of the Manhattan Institute and to Jonas Kron of Trillium Asset Management for sharing their insights. And to our listeners, we hope you join us again for the next three Wednesdays. MarketWatch retirement reporter Ali Melito will host a retirement series. Tomorrow, Ali will discuss with Roger Ma, financial planner and founder of Life Laid Out, and Julie Alma Taveras, founder of Investing Latina, about the do's and don'ts of retirement saving and investing. Thank you all for listening. Stay healthy, stay safe.